Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. Kevin Kelly is this week's episode. He is known for many things, but a couple of them are founding team of Wired Magazine and starting the Long Now Foundation, which aims to solve problems in a 10,000-year time frame. More than a few people refer to Kevin Kelly as the most interesting person in the world. In this podcast, we talk about what happens when robots take our jobs, how success to Kevin means doing things that only you can uniquely do, how Kevin didn't have his first job till he was 35, and his first drug experience till he was 50, and a lot of other things. This is a very wide-ranging conversation and definitely one of my favorites. So, all right, here's Kevin. Silver Cord, it says you've on your website you've been working on this for 11 years. Is that true?
Yes. Silver Cord is a graphic novel that was my first attempt at fiction. And since I didn't know what I was doing, I only began because there was a couple other people that were in my circle who had done graphic novels before. And a few of them actually were screenwriters at Pixar. So we decided to embark on a project together, and it was all very much of a moonlighting job for everybody concerned. And it took us 11 years to do, but that was in part because we doubled the assignment and made two books over those 11 years and published it as one book.
Is that a project, is writing a graphic novel something that you'd wanted to do for years and something that you had on a long list of projects I would love to work on? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, I think I read comics as a kid, although interestingly, this would have been in the 50s, the 1950s. We were prohibited from reading comics, and so we used to have to sneak off to our friend's house under a porch to read them. And so I read the real classics, Superman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, and that was about it. I mean, it was pretty small set of things that we could get our hands on because we couldn't buy them. But I think I graduated from that to science fiction when I was in junior high school and high school. I didn't really keep up with it, but I did become interested again when they morphed from being comic books to becoming graphic novels for adults. And then I was interested in it again as a way to, it's kind of like, it was a way of kind of like making a movie cheaply. I mean, in a certain sense, movies are, the real cultural center. Graphic novels and comic books kind of graduate to movies. So they're a little bit kind of like a step before. So this was an easy way for us to kind of explore the idea of a cinematic treatment to the idea. And so I think it was on a list of things that I wanted to do and I thought I could do. I learned a whole lot from doing it. And I certainly wouldn't try something as ambitious as a first attempt next time. I think you start smaller, but we got carried away.
What's interesting about you is that you have a lot of these projects and communities you've been building over the years, obviously. How do you prioritize? How do you know when I can take this project on, or how do you think about when to take projects on and how to organize it so you're not spreading yourself too thin?
It's a really great question when you have sort of a gadfly like myself who has lots of things. Deciding which ones you're going to commit to is a real art. I would say several things. One is you're kind of looking for something, a project that is kind of achievable, right on the edge of achievable, where it's not so, it seems so impossible that you would need, the luck of a lottery to accomplish it, or, some world-class help. But it's not something that is just trivial as well. And I think one of the things I look for is I'm trying to optimize learning. And so it would be will I learn a lot no matter what happens? And that was the case in this, during the graphic novel, was even if it didn't succeed in the sense that it didn't get very far or wasn't very good or whatever, I knew that I was going to learn a really lot about fiction because I had never really written fiction before. I'm starting a project right now. I just handed in my newest book just a couple days ago. And so now I'm working on a project that I'm not sure will work at all. It's probably likely to fail, but I know that I'll learn a lot. A little bit. It has to do with trying to make some forecasts for the future in a kind of quantitative way. And so I was just talking to somebody who I think knows more about this than anybody. We had lunch together and trying to get a sense of, like, is this totally insane? Is there any chance that this will work? And it seems like it's like, you know, maybe, might, possibly, but most likely won't. And that's sort of, you know, that's a good spot to be in. It's an experiment. And so I think of things as an experiment. You want to make an experiment that is going to work, but you have a pretty high tolerance for failure if you are sure that you're going to learn a lot from doing it.
It's interesting. I'm curious, you know, the various projects you do have, for example, the Long Now, which is looking at the future, or the Rosetta Project, which is, you know, storing languages, or the project that's around species, or your various writings. Did you, you know, years ago, did you think about, here are all the things I eventually want to do, and let me do them in the order that makes most sense? You know, Tim Ferriss has this concept of the domino theory, which is, I'll knock down the dominoes. I want to knock down a lot of dominoes. I'll knock down the first domino that makes every other domino easier to knock over.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I don't have my life planned out any way like that. I don't have a bucket list.
Is it impossible to do that? Or?
Oh no, I think people are different and they have different ways that they structure or try to control their lives. But I am much more inclined to be serendipitous and opportunistic at times, and I think. I think some people earlier in life have a better realization of what they're really good at. And I think I was a late bloomer. I didn't really have my first full-time job until I was 35. So I was before then just doing things without a career. And so other people kind of, you know, and by the time they're in high school, they kind of have a very clear idea of what they want to do and they're kind of going after it and they maybe have a long-term goal and they can kind of set up the dominoes. But one of the things I have realized by now is that there's many paths to success and there are many definitions of success. And I think part of being successful is actually working on your definition. And I think we're often, we take other people's definition of success and try to imitate it. And I think probably in the end, the best kind of successes are ones that only, that's your definition only, that only applies to you.
And what's your definition?
Well, for me, it has been maximizing learning, I guess I would call it a roundedness of I actually try to not specialize too much. So it would be kind of a generalization, remaining interested in many things, but doing enough things well that you can actually survive. I think, you know, it's kind of like the Heinlein thing of specializations for insects. I think I liked to dabble in things. I like to success for me is in keeping my mind flexible and changing my mind, which is another type of learning. I think success is also having a control of my time. And that's for many people a real goal, which is to be able to choose what they do during a day or do next. And that was always a very high thing on my my list, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't have a full time job until I was 35, because I wanted to control my time. So maintaining that control, I think, is a big thing on my list.
And until you were 35, you were freelancing, you were writing, you were community building, you were traveling. Were there other big things you were doing?
Well, actually, I wasn't doing a lot of those things.
Oh, interesting. What were you doing?
I was I was traveling with a camera and other adventures, like riding a bicycle across the country and hiking the Appalachian Trail, but mostly spending time in Asia and in photography, working kind of the minimalist amount that I needed to work to keep going. So I didn't own anything. I had some cameras, a bicycle, a backpack, a sleeping bag. And I wasn't really plugged in. I wasn't writing at all. I was just doing photography. And so those things came later. But in the beginning, what I was trying to do was, I was basically in school, and the school was just, you know, the world, Asia primarily, trying to understand how things worked, trying to see for myself with my own eyes an eyewitness of how things are done. And that's why I was attracted to Asia, because everything was done out in the open. It was all kind of like done in the front of this, on the street, and you could walk around and just see how everything happened. And that that was, you know, I was filling my self with those experiences, and seeing the world being transformed and people lifting themselves from, you know, subsistence agriculture to, you know, making the futuristic cities of the world right before my eyes. And so I think in a certain sense, I was in grad school until that time, just learning how things worked.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I'm friends with your daughter, Ting. We're about the same age. And it seems that she has kind of, one, this also richness of spirit, but also, you know, similar philosophy in that she's traveling a lot, she's exploring a lot, she's doing a lot of different adventures.
Yeah, I think we did some traveling together as a family, and when they were kids, when they were younger, and I recommend it both for, I think it's essential for young people to keep your mind nimble, to keep being exposed to different ways of thinking about things, different ways of doing things, and having your own ideas continually challenged. And I think that's what travel does for me, and why I keep doing it is it helps me to think different. And you know, it's not that I'm going to think like the places I'm going to, but just because they think different will force onto me an attempt to try to think differently about something that we all assume is true, or that we all know about, which we don't really know. But that sense of being confronted with the otherness, I think, is really, really valuable. And I think in young people especially, I mean, I've long advocated for a national service for all kids for 2 years. You choose what you want to do, Peace Corps, Visa, whatever it is, military, it's up to you. But you should spend some time out of the country when you're that age. And that would really transform our country for very little cost.
And another, that's a great argument, but also people also say that people should just go to college later when they're a bit more mature. Maybe their minds are ready. Maybe they've worked a bit or traveled a bit and can take it more seriously.
I think that's true. We have a lot of data that older students are better students. And that would make a lot of sense to me, is instead of going to college right after high school, you spent 2 years abroad or doing something, volunteering. I think that would be really, really powerful. And, you know, if I had been that's what I needed after high school. And if I had actually had that, I might have gone to school and finished and gotten a degree. But out of high school, I just couldn't take another 4 years sitting in a classroom. It was just, that was not for me. And I suspect it's not for a lot of other people too, as well.
It wasn't for me either. I mean, I did stick around, unfortunately, and pay quite a bit. But you know, do you think a lot about education or next level kind of university system? Is there something are there examples out there, whether it's Minerva or Make School or Alt School, that you're really excited about, or is that a project you'll take on at some point?
I don't think so. I'm fully convinced that there is a disruption happening. And I'm very gladdened by it. And I am, I've been a long time subscriber to places like Lynda and stuff where you can get courses. So I believe and use that stuff. But I don't have a really good intuition about where it's going or what shape it should be. And I think in part because I don't think there's going to be a single answer. I think that the era when there was kind of a one size, one shape, college, higher education, which kind of looked the same or at least appeared to look the same and people had a vision of what it should be. I don't think we're ever going to come back to that, and there will be multiple ways and multiple versions depending on person's own learning habits and their needs. And I think all these experiments going on right now are unlikely to converge and more likely to keep diverging. And so that we'll have, multiple ways of continuous lifelong learning, which is, basically where we're going. And I think all the ones you mentioned are all great experiments in that direction, but I don't see them kind of settling onto just one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just continuous lifelong learning, but also this sort of desire, especially as we live longer and especially for people who do well in their careers, and they want kind of friendships and belonging and kind of this adult summer camp or this adult college experience.
Yeah, and I think there are many ways to learn, and online is certainly going to be a big portion of that. But as we can tell from the perennial appeal of places like TED, EG conferences, PopTech, all these others, face-to-face learning or learning in the physical next to other people or from someone else will never go away and has, in some senses, increasing value when these others also increase. And it will just be another option and is not to be belittled at all. I think the desire to hang out with people while you're learning will continue. It's just that there'll be more ways to do that, more ways to arrange that experience. Summer camps, that's a great idea. Bus tours, cruises, week-long conferences. These are all Burning Man. These are all different venues, and I expect there'll be more of them. And so it's not just online, remote, digital learning.
One thing I think about in terms of developing friendships and communities as I get older is, one, exploring with the idea of intentional communities of living, in places where, people want to do similar types of stuff. And also, these kind of, what you just mentioned, these kind of retreat or one-off week experiences, but that have kind of alumni and, repetitive in some capacity. How do you think about friendships as you've gotten older and right now in your life?
Yeah. I think, like lots of things, it's something you have to cultivate, that you actually have to put energy into it. Again, like other things, the more energy you put into it, the more powerful and important it can be. So, I do spend energy in that direction deliberately, and it's not something that you can put on automatic. So, reaching out.
How deep versus how wide do you go? Do you go, really deep with a few people and then wide with a lot of people, or do you have a lot of people that you go fairly deep with, or how do you think about that?
That's a good question. I would say I have around the Dunbar's number, 125 people that I would cultivate, communicate with, send, you know, put on a Christmas list, and that I would track or read or say on social media. So I think it's, you know, that's a human scale thing. It's harder to kind of track beyond that. And of course there's a subcircle of those that are closer. So, the number of acquaintances of course grow longer and wider, but, I really wouldn't call that friends. I had a friend who defined a friend as somebody who would, pick you up at the airport, and then a best friend was somebody who would get you out of jail. And I think those are probably pretty good definitions.
I hear you. I've been searching for kind of definition of a friend. One thing I've come to is someone who's dedicated to your personal and spiritual growth. But Tim, he was talking about his friendship with Josh Waitzkin and how they, you know, he wants friends who don't want him to call them because they know how they like appreciate that he's so passionate about what he's doing and that the other is so passionate about what they're doing too. Not to botch Tim's words. And of course they call each other too, but does that make sense? Like they know.
Yeah. I think, yeah. In terms of whether you're needy, I mean, another way to phrase that is that you don't want to be and this I think also goes true for like in a work situation or, not just in a kind of a social situation, but also others. And that is I much rather be a solution than a problem for someone. In other words, not adding to their to-do list, but taking something from their to-do list. So I think maybe that's what Tim was suggesting is that he didn't want to have another thing he had to do, whereas a friend might actually relieve him of something he had to do.
Yeah. And it's interesting, this concept of tribe has started to get a lot more popularized. Dave Brooks had a column where he said, if I had $500 million, I'd dedicate it to kind of adult summer camps or these fellowships that are typically career oriented, but make them more, you know, relationship and community oriented.
Yeah. It's probably not what I would do with that money, but,
what would you do with that money?
Yeah. So, I would actually fund some science that, I think needs to get done, more kind of a citizen science kind of a thing. I would put it in places that may not get, you know, venture funding. There doesn't seem to be an easy return on, but I think that the research and the learning that would come from it would have a cascading effect.
What are some of these areas?
Oh boy, well, right now the oceans are still, unknown. I was involved with All Species trying to catalog, all the living species on the planet. And, we know, you know, most of the birds, we know most of the larger animals and the charismatic species, but we don't know very many of the insects and smaller, and we know virtually very little about, say, the deep seas. And there's just not a lot of, you know, return on investment right now to do those kinds of surveys. They're very, very expensive. But there's no doubt in my mind that something really good would come out of it. And recently there's a lot of talk about genetic technology called CRISPR. CRISPR was came out of proteins and chemicals and molecules that were found in hot springs bacteria. So here is somebody way off on the edge who was looking at the bacteria that grows into hot springs, not being funded by anybody. It was pure science, and yet, you know, down the line, it's going to become one of the most valuable technologies that we have. And I think that kind of long-term investment, taking chances. And I think most anything that we discover will eventually become very, very valuable later on, even if it appears to be completely frivolous right now, like the guys studying origami. Who would have thought origami had any practical use? But it turns out that it's
it does. Like,
oh, sure. It turns out that, for one thing, they were doing things like in NASA trying to unfurl sails, you know, these great big solar sails. Well, they're into this little tiny package and they unfold, and that's all origami. And so these guys who have been doing origami for years and years suddenly were issuing patents on how to unfold solar sails. And then also protein folding, the ways in which you actually fold a protein are basically the same kind of folds and sequence of folds that origami has. And these guys knew all kinds of the mathematics of origami. And so those are the kinds of things that I would fund with that kind of money.
And is that what the Long Now is essentially trying to do? Focus the conversation on what, you know, maybe venture funding or different types of funding are a bit short-sighted about? Or what are your critiques of what's happening now and what are you trying
to do? So the Long Now is a foundation in the sense that it's a nonprofit. It doesn't have any money that it gives away. It runs on a very small budget donated by others. But its mission is to encourage and foster long-term thinking. We're agnostic about what that long-term thinking is, whether it's plans or a vision that you have or that someone has or institution has. We don't really care what it is. All we're saying is we're trying to encourage people to think in terms of generations, to start something that might take more than one generation to finish, and to develop some tools that would help you to work on and follow through on a project that might last several generations. And so those are the kinds of things. And for instance, cataloging all the species on Earth is probably something that will take more than one generation. And that is the kind of thing that we're trying to promote, is to be willing to invest in something that might take more than one.
And how do you think about getting people to care about that?
If you're trying to maximize your return on investment, you're not going to wait 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years. And so there's the incentive in the business world is not aligned in that direction. In the, you know, we were talking about universities. In the old days, universities were aligned. They were, in theory, committed to the 25-year horizon, trying to do things that business wouldn't. But in fact, they've also been somewhat bitten by more shorter-term thinking, trying to, again, maximize their investments. And so universities aren't quite doing that generational business as they used to. Long Now doesn't have money, but what we're trying to do is convene people who are thinking in these terms and try to develop maybe some practices and techniques that would help someone try and do something in the long term.
How are you thinking about getting people to care about this when it's so tempting to think about, you know, short term and what's right in front of you,
yeah,
making money in?
Well, the best we could do, I think, was to provoke people. And Stuart Brand, who was one of the founders of Long Now, had a great history in doing that. He made the comparison of when he was young, in his 20s, he noticed that we were sending satellites up into space to take pictures of the Earth. But when they left the Earth's orbit, they always faced outward. And so that we didn't actually have a photograph of the entire Earth as a whole. And he started a campaign himself as a single person, making buttons and standing in front of universities and NASA headquarters saying, why haven't we seen a picture of the whole Earth? And when they actually had an impact, and they did turn the cameras around to take a picture of the whole Earth, because at that time it was kind of like frivolous. Well, why would you? And when that picture of the whole Earth came about, that provoked basically the environmental movement. Just that picture, and everybody could see that thing, the little blue marble hanging in space, they realize, well, there's nothing. If you throw garbage out, there's nowhere it goes. It doesn't go away. That there is just one home. And that image had more to do with the beginnings of the environmental movement and the green movement today, which is really very, very profound, than anything else. So his idea was you can provoke someone with an iconic, mythic image. And we're trying to do the same thing with the clock of the Long Now, which is a clock which has been being built to tick for 10,000 years. And it's in will be inside a mountain in western Texas, though there will be other clocks around the world. And inside that mountain, the clock continues to go and tick, and every day it will sound a different melody than the day before for 10,000 years, whether anybody is there or not. And there's a pilgrimage route to it and through the clock, which is 500 feet tall, inside this mountain. And just the fact that the clock is there, even if you never visit it, provokes the question, well, you know, what would you measure with a clock to tick for 10,000 years? What else can you do with that kind of a perspective? So it's the clock is meant to do the same thing that the whole Earth image did, which is provoke people to think about what they might do on a different time scale than even there are, you know, the 5 years or, you know, for that much, 5 months.
Now, you were part of the team that built out the quantified self movement, correct?
Yeah.
And so you know a lot about, and you wrote, of course, you know, Thousand True Fans with the philosophy that, you know, you don't, it, rather than making sure, seeing that tons of people know about you, just make sure the 1,000 people really love you. Is that a correct?
Well, the Thousand True Fans concept was started off as a theory. And the theory is just a mathematical realization, which was that if you as an artist had direct contact with your fans, so in the kind of like a Kickstarter way, which was pre-Kickstarter, the idea would be that and you could sell them something on a regular basis, say you sold them $100 worth of merchandise every year, then you needed only 1,000 of them to have a livelihood. And I would define it, true fan is a fan that would go out of their way to buy whatever it is that you produce. To, if you're a photographer, they would get the frame prints. If you were a musician, they would buy the box set, go 200 miles to see you play. If you were a writer, they would buy every single edition that you had and have an autographed copy. Whatever it was, their true fans were your most diehard, avid fans who just take whatever you could produce. Of course, there were a lot of other lesser fans around them, but you only needed 1,000 of them. And 1,000 is, you know, that's 3 new a day for a year, or just 1 day for 3 years. It's something that's achievable. You can kind of imagine it. You might even be able to remember all their names. It's something that's doable. And that would be a success for many sculptors or filmmakers or whatever. And it wasn't a million. You didn't need a million. You didn't need to have a platinum bestseller to have success. You could redefine success as instead of making a fortune, you made a living. And I think the idea of 1,000 True Fans was that this new technology would allow you to do that. And of course, after I wrote that, the crowdsource things like Kickstarter came across, and they were the manifestation of that impulse, which is I'll have my true fans basically pre-fund the project that I'm working on because I have direct contact with them. And, you know, this, I say it was theory because there's lots of things that have to be adjusted for. Like if you're not a solo artist, if you're a band, then you have to kind of multiply things by the number of people in the group. And then secondly, not every artist wants to spend their time interacting with fans, and they might rather just paint or make music, and they don't want to have to deal with the fans. Well, then you need to have another person involved, and that sort of, again, changes the equation. But the order of magnitude is not really going to change. You can still, in the thousands, probably do something again, if you have direct contact with them, which you don't if you're selling a book through New York or through a music label. So it was this kind of change of dealing with a smaller set of people that you have a relationship with versus trying to disperse things widely without really knowing who those people are.
And I, from what I read, it was this philosophy and also this concept of, you know, making things super simple, making it super easy to get involved and rise that led to the quantified self spreading. What do you think?
Yeah, the quantified self was a little bit separate. It was something Gary Wolf and I started, I guess, about 8 years ago now. And the premise there was technology like the initial pedometers and the Nike Fuel Band were making the sensors that the phone basically brought to us, the cheap sensors, were making tracking so easy that it becomes free, and that once that happened, there would be all these amazing things that would come out of that. And so we were trying to discuss and figure out and think about and in some ways manage, if not influence, what happened when self-tracking, volunteer self-tracking, became the norm. And so it wasn't the norm when we started, but we're saying it's going to become the new normal. And we didn't know what the answer was. We just decided to have meetups and invite people who were, if they thought you were self-tracking, you'd come and talk about what you were doing. So we had a show and tell every month, and we simply listened to what people said they were doing and asked them questions about how it was changing what they were doing. And we kind of let the community define or decide what quantified self meant. You know, it continues to go on. It's still changing what it means. And of course, now there's thousands of different sensing devices, and there'll be another 1,000 tomorrow. You know, it's way, way, way beyond us, but the concept and the term is still there, which is that we can use numbers to investigate ourselves, not just words. And I think that's the big step that we're moving into now.
How did you spread those meetups? How did you build that initial community?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I just announced on my blog the first meetup, and I said, you know, we've coined this term, quantified self. If you think you're quantified selfing, come to my studio on this day. And much to my amazement, 25 people showed up, and I hadn't really met any of them. One of them actually was Tim Ferriss. And they came and started telling about all these amazing things that they were doing, which I had no idea that was going on. And we decided it was so cool that we would just do one every month. And we've in the Bay Area, and now they spread all around 30 different countries around the world, and they still have basically a monthly meeting in the Bay Area still going on. So we spread it, I guess, it was a little bit pre-social media, just by talking about it. It was very organic. So all I can say is that we actually deliberately did not try and force it. We just sort of tried not to you know, deflate it. We just kind of let it rise naturally and fed it, and only minimally, just by you know, letting other people talk about it. So it's a very organic process, meaning that's kind of very slow. And if we were trying to run a business, we would certainly have been impatient and would have done things to accelerate it and intensify it. But we were trying to start a movement. In that sense, we wanted to let it run a little bit more at its own growth rate. The result of that, I think it endured through, you know, the recession, which if it had been a business trying to optimize profits, it probably wouldn't have made it. So there's an advantage in kind of going long and slow, which is that you have a much more robust organization because it has a much more natural kind of organic base.
And is that what you're trying to do with Long Now as well?
Yes. Of course, you know, that's the joke, is we're taking the long view. You know, what's the hurry we've got? But in fact, I think the challenge for Long Now is actually not funding. It's the fact that the board, the founders, the group are all gray beards. And there's a few women, but they're of a different generation. And for Long Now to really survive, it needs another couple of generations younger to take up and own the idea, in the same way that the environmental movement has certainly succeeded in that sense of there's probably as, you know, as many young people in identifying that way as old. And I think our challenge right now with long-term thinking is to make sure that the younger generation are as enthusiastic about it as their first generation.
Mm-hmm. As you're, you know, doing these various initiatives and trying to, in some ways, kind of create the world you want to see, or create, you know, initiatives that support that, do you get discouraged by people who have more say or more money or more power and are doing things that you don't like?
No, it's not worth focusing there. There's, I think it was even Jeff Bezos who used to talk about how they, as a business, Amazon was always trying to not focus on the competition and respond to competition, but just sort of really focus on the customers. And I think, I personally am not motivated by the people who are doing the wrong things or, as much as trying to seize opportunities to move forward, and to do something new or innovative or differently. So I think that bias is probably pretty much shared by most of the group of the Long Now. We actually have one of our heuristics. We have a set of heuristics for Long Now Foundation. One of them is to make allies as much as possible and not make enemies. And so making enemies is really good for short-term advance. But for the long term, you want to make as many allies as possible. And that means, you know, even cooperating with people that you disagree with and finding places you do agree and moving forward. So I think we're much more likely to find areas of strength and work on those rather than areas that don't work.
Is there some threshold, though, where this changes? You know, is there some scenario in which the enemies are, let's just say, environmentally, like, you know, causing too much greenhouse gases or doing something that's, you know, path dependently ruining things, and people have to step in? Or does it ever feel like a war of ideas? You know, how do you?
No, I think that is not helpful. The war metaphor, I think, is a disservice, particularly if you're trying to go along. It's much better to understand that you were in various iterations, you're eventually going to have work with those people, that they're not going anywhere. They're going to be your neighbor in metaphorically and in real life. And that it's much better to focus on solutions that appeal or that work for everybody involved. And I think thinking as a battle or as a war of ideas is that's kind of like the zero sum thinking. I think if you take the non-zero sum thinking, which is that in some ways that having a conflict is actually good, and that out of that will come something else, a third thing. So I'm really into triangulation. Whenever there is a polarized debate, you know, it's black versus white, you say, well, what about yellow? You take it out of that, the confrontation, the bipolar confrontation, and it always is much better and often where the solution comes from.
I've been watching a lot of Black Mirror recently, and I read The Circle, so I'm a bit on dystopian kick. I don't know if you've seen those things or read those things.
I've read Circle and I loved it. I thought it was really great. I have to say that it was a little uncomfortable because the guy who was sort of, I wouldn't call him the villain, but the the guy who was sort of, well, he was sort of the anti-protagonist, was me. I mean, he was saying all the things I'm saying about transparency and going clear, and these, and so I heard myself as you know, the young gal, and it could have been my daughter. I could hear her saying these same things, and so I just loved it because of that, because it was really very it was very clear. And my take on the circle is that it will be it's like 1984. It's sort of like an extreme version of the world that really can't happen, but as a mythic cautionary tale, it works. So it's like it's not really very plausible in its details. We can certainly go in that direction, but it's the fact that it's sort of this end state that marks a direction, and it makes the direction very visible. And for that reason, I think it's an incredibly valuable book, even though I don't think that it's at all plausible. Black Mirror is the same kind of a thing. It kind of exaggerates the likelihood. It's not really plausible the way it is, but by isolating and making extreme, it makes it visible, and therefore you can talk about it.
Yeah, but so that's interesting. You're super gung-ho on radical transparency?
Yeah. I just finished a book which the working title is called The Inevitable, and I think one of the things that's inevitable is total surveillance. I think just as the internet wants to copy things, and anything that can be copied, if you put it on the internet, will be copied. Copied is how, multiple copies is how things work on the internet. You can't stop copies. Copy protection doesn't work. You have to kind of work with the copies and then, you know, make things that are more valuable than the copies. The same thing with tracking. Anything that can be tracked will be tracked on the internet. We're making self-tracking, friends track you, companies track us, governments track us. Everybody's going to be tracking it. The question is how we make that tracking civilized, how we tame it and civilize it and make it symmetrical. So right now, a lot of the tracking is not symmetrical. They are tracking us. We don't know about them. We don't know what they know. We can't correct it. We don't benefit from it. It's not accountable. So there's no symmetry, but what we want to have is we want to be able to watch the watchers, to track what's being tracked, to correct it, to benefit, have it accountable, have it lawful. And all these things will make it much more comfortable for us. I think we are going to be comfortable because for at least 10,000 years, humans have been living in groups where basically you surveilled each other all the time. That's our normal mode. It's only very recently, very, very recently, where that wasn't true. But we have evolved to have transparent lives. And so I think if there is symmetry in the transparency, then we will be comfortable with it. But I don't think it's going to be easy to do. And I think...
Oh, you mean technically?
Yeah, I think there's going to be, we need to institute cultural etiquette, and we have to have technical solutions about how to do this, which we don't have right now. So, and I think there will be, you know, I think it's going to take work, and there'll be pain involved in terms of things that we don't like until we get it right. I don't think it's going to be easy to do, but I think it is possible.
What is getting it right look like? Like people's personal lives, people's romantic lives, people, you know, people's, is that all public? Is that, you know, what's the role of privacy?
Think of a small town.
When everyone's up in your shit.
Yeah. Think of a small town. It's like, there is, you know, the lady across the street knew what you were doing, who was over at your house, how long. But there are several things. One is when you were gone, if someone who wasn't there normally was there, she'd call the cops. And two, you would watch her, and you know, you knew who was watching you, and you could hold her accountable for what she knew. She'd take in your mail when you were gone. So there was very clear benefits for that, and it felt more symmetrical. But I think that kind of, if you're asking what it feels like, that's what it feels like.
Do you see in the future that private relationships still exist, or is it everything public?
What do you mean by private?
You know, one to one, and no one else can see. No one else can see. No one else can know.
I think there is a cost to that that will be very high.
What is it?
Well, what I mean literally cost, in the sense of there's a great book that I recommend called How to Be Invisible, but a guy whose job it is, people hire him to make them invisible. And he basically correctly says that, you know, you choose the level of visibility that you want, and it's a matter of economics. So, and he defines it as how much it would cost to find you. So, for $1,000, I mean, if someone's willing to spend $1,000, they could find you at this level. Or you can get $10,000 worth of invisibility, which would cost $10,000 to find you. Or you could get $100,000 worth of invisibility, meaning that it would cost the agencies and other people $100,000 to find you. And then there's the government, which basically has unlimited resources. And basically, if they want to find you, they're going to find you. So you say invisible. Well, I'm saying to what level? It may be invisible to the $1,000 level. It's not going to be invisible to the government level.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about this a lot with Meerkat and Periscope. I was a very early user of Meerkat, and I would get really excited about, you know, all this attention. I was streaming everything, and then I don't know. I got kind of weirded out that it encouraged this kind of performative behavior. I saw one stream that was a Periscope stream that was highlighted, like, stalking my ex while her boyfriend's watching, and then or while her boyfriend's there, and there were like 200 people watching, egging him on. Like, it seemed to encourage all these sorts of perverse behaviors. So, what are the why are you so optimistic about a fully transparent, fully recorded future?
Because I think, I actually am not that enthusiastic. I just think that it's inevitable. It's not the one I would choose, but I don't see any way around it. And it's like AI, really, really smart AI is inevitable. But it's not maybe necessarily the one, they'll take all our jobs, which I think they will. It's not necessarily the one I would choose. I just think that's the way it's going. And the same thing with copies. It was not really I used to make money selling books, which is not, you can't really do that anymore. Musicians have the same problem. So it's not really not the way I would have arranged it, but I'm just saying this is the way it's going. This is what's inevitable about it. And I think we can make it work. Things like the performance, I think, are just self-limiting and self-correcting. I was just noticing the other day that when cell phones came along, they were kind of big, fat, and loud, and they were ringing everywhere. And if you try to imagine what the future of cell phones, when everybody had one, all you can imagine was this endless cacophony of cell phones going off, people shouting into them, and all this stuff. That didn't happen. One thing is because we invented the technology, the vibrator, so it was all silent. So you don't have them going off in the middle of movies. And secondly, people also had a social etiquette. They understood that if the person in front of them was reading a screen, it was distracting. So social etiquette says you don't do that. And that actually begins to work. And so this Meerkat is on Periscope is all of what, 3 months old? Come on, give us some time to figure it out. It's going to take several years before we figure out the social etiquette, the sustainable relationship with these things. Anonymity, I'm really down on. I think it's way overused. And the source of a lot of the problems with social media. So I think we over time will learn how to behave with this. It's not just a matter. It's not binary. It's not like it's on or it's off. There's all the different levels of use.
So people like Nicholas Carr, Jaron Lanier are seem like vocal, to some extent, vocal critics of some things that are happening in technology or warning of some things in the future. Are you just not a pessimist about it? Are you just a realist and there's nothing we could do? Or how do you think on some of these issues? Are you not doomsday about AI or VR?
I'm off the chart optimistic about them. And I, like I say, the optimists are the ones who actually write history. The thing about the critics like Jaron or Nick Carr, Cherry Turkle, I often agree with them, but in my metaphor, they are the brakes that you need to turn. I mean, if you're in a vehicle going 100 miles an hour, in order to turn to steer, you have to brake. So we need them because they're the brake that we need to turn and steer. But I'm just much more interested in the engine that moves it forward and keeps it going. And so that's their role, and I honor and I think we need to listen to them. But listening to the brakes means that you kind of like, you know, you just let go of the brakes every now and then and you race forward. And so I'm interested in racing forward. And how to do that and how to keep it going and all that. And they're interested in braking, and as long as we don't let the brakes take over, we'll be fine.
So what is the biggest thing you're scared about or feel ethically conflicted about?
Cyber warfare. Primarily because we have no rules right now. And I think that the amount of hacking, both state and rogue, you know, bands. It's vast, way beyond what we can see. And the problem is that it's very hard to tell who's doing what. But we're going to start doing things offensively that we haven't decided yet. It's like kind of drone warfare. It's like we really aren't acknowledging our responsibilities here, and it's because there's no agreed on rule. I mean, again, we're sending drones over there. If China's sending drones over here, or do we think that's right? I mean, not just right in terms of whether it's. I mean, do you think that's an appropriate way of resolving conflict? And so, it's kind of a lawless area, not very civilized. And I worry because I think it's going to take a disaster of some level before we come together. And it's not something that will be solved at the nation level. It's an international, transnational, global thing. There will be no national security without global security is what I'm saying these days. And so we're very reluctant to think globally. For some weird reason, we're allergic to the idea of global government or governance. And I don't understand that, because obviously if we visited any other advanced planet in the galaxy, they would have global planetary governance. But we don't want it. I don't know why. I think cyber warfare is one of the places where that will show the need that we have for global governance, because you can't have national cybersecurity without having global security.
And so when we think about innovation and the rate that the engine is going, are you mostly excited with what's happening in Silicon Valley and elsewhere at the rate of innovation, and just wish that they were focused on stuff that was just a little bit more future focused, or do you have kind of heavier criticisms?
No, I'm very impressed with the speed at which things are going on. And I don't really have any critique of how, you know, VCs are allotting funds. My critique is much more at the level of, say, the U.S. government, which is spending some crazy gazillion dollars on aircraft carriers and military and, like, you know, whatever it is, 1 or 2% on science, basic science, and even education. It, just imagine how powerful we'd be if we flipped that around. If we took the military budget and put it into science, or took the science budget and ran our military, we would be. I mean, the world would be better. We would be more powerful. It's not. I don't have any beef at all with Wall Street or the VCs. I just want the gains that we have from that to flow back into government research, pure research, education, lifelong learning, and away from building, you know, crazy aircraft carriers or Iraq wars, which trillions of dollars are spent on. That's the place that I'm unhappy with.
Yeah, and you know, this is interesting. Full circle. You spent a lot of time in Asia. Your wife is Asian, correct?
Yeah, she's Chinese.
You're very familiar with, you know, Eastern culture. What's the intersection for you between kind of spirituality and technology? Do you worry that as we become more focused on gadgets and these platforms and these virtual worlds that it does something to the soul?
Well, yeah, that's a great segue back to the silver cord, which we mentioned at the very beginning of. This was the silver cord is a graphic novel that I was involved in. We kickstarted the printing of the 2-volume book. It's this huge, oversized, humongous art book, 470 pages of graphic nicety and goodness. And the premise of the book is it combines angels and robots. It's about putting souls into the first conscious robots. So in our book, the robots are already intelligent. They're just not conscious. They get a Q-chip, quantum chip that actually infuses consciousness into them. And that consciousness is what it is that these million different species of angels are trying to get embodied on the planet. Normally, they have to go through a process where they have moral education, but in this case, they're going to jump circuit it and come into the first robots. So you have these kind of uneducated souls inside of robots, and they start to do bad things. And there's a half angel, half girl who discovers through astral travel that this is about to happen. That's the basic premise of it. So I think that for people who can go to a redwoods forest and stand there and feel as if they were in a cathedral and have a sense that there is something beyond them, it's maybe some reflection of the divine. I think that technology will become so complicated and evolved over time that we will have similar feelings in our future technology, where they will approach living things and we'll have the same aura around them and the same sense of the divine when we are before them. So I don't think of technology as being soulless. I think, in fact, that it can and will contain as much soul as one would think nature does. And if you don't think nature does, well, then you probably aren't going to think that technology does. But if you do think that there is a sense of a reflection of the divine in nature, I think you're going to feel the same in the machines that we make and the technology we make, and particularly when we get to the point of making really robust, conscious AIs and robots. One of them is going to stand up and say, "I am a child of God." And we have to have a response at that point.
And your response is?
But you baptize them. I think the response is that we take it them seriously. And so actually, I've one of my projects, the long-term projects, you asked about projects, is I'm writing something called a catechism for robots. So the idea is that when they eventually do ask us, is that we have a response. We have, well, here's here's what we, you know, here's your answer. It's a catechism kind of rehearses that, like, you know, where am I, you know, if you, the Baltimore Catechism was a great Catholic catechism, which did a kind of call and response, like, you know, who made me, why was I made? And so we'd have something very similar for robots.
If there were, you're just talking about projects, if there were three Kevin Kellys, if you could, you know, clone yourself, what are some other, you know, big projects that you want to take on?
Yeah, oh my gosh. Oh boy.
Or delegate. You seem to be really good at delegating.
Yeah, I do. And I have to say that I'd learned that late in life, and I wish I had learned it earlier. That I don't, you know, I came up of age of the do it yourself hippie, and there was a huge kind of, I wouldn't say morality, but certainly a culture that you did things yourself. And it is really a great way to learn things, but I think I was stuck there and I didn't realize that you could actually hire people who were better than yourself to do these things. If I had two more of me, what would I do? I have a list somewhere. I'm interested in, we were talking before about science fiction. I'm interested in science fiction. I read it as a kid. I didn't read it in my middle years of life, for whatever reason. I think maybe the movies came along. They were doing science fiction better in some ways. I'd rather watch the movie than read the book. But I'm re-engaged and more interested in that now. I think partly because I've been writing books about the future, and it's so hard to be nonfiction. It's so hard to write those. I'd rather just make it up. I think I would do something in that, you know, in terms of making a movie or making it even a documentary, which I haven't done, but I know from making a graphic novel, the number of hours required is just insane. And, I think I would need a couple clones to do that.
Yeah. And, I don't want to cut you off. Was there another project you wanted to talk about?
Well, as I said, I have a long list of them, but I'm not sure how much benefit it is just to talk about things that I don't think are ever going to get done, because I don't have these clones. I think
maybe listeners who are similar minded.
Yeah. I'm here. Here's how I operate, which is. Done me very well, which is normally and generally I'm really happy to tell my ideas, good ideas, the better ideas, better to tell them to other people, because I'm actually interested in other people's doing those things. If other people can do them, then that means I don't have to do them. And in fact, I'm trying to construct my life to do the things that only I can do. So part of that is, part of that process is telling people these good ideas that I think are good ideas. And hoping that someone else will do them, because then that means that I don't have to do them. So in that sense, I talking about these might encourage someone else. So there was the unfinished project that I have was the catalog of all the species on the planet. That has not been done yet. That's still undone. Requires a champion to oversee that, to garner extra funding. The typical taxonomist has a celebratory party if they can get a $10,000 grant, which is basically the plastics budget for most biolabs. It's a test tube budget. They'll spend $10,000 just on throwaway plastic test tubes, but that is the entire budget of most taxonomists, and so they are just hurting for money. And part of what needs to be done is to find extra money for them to finish cataloging all the species on this planet. And then another project that I began and didn't finish and would like to return to is something along now. It's called Long Bets, where we encourage people to make predictions that have money involved or to bet someone else on a, something in the future, the long future, that of consequence, as a means of sharpening our arguments and our logic about thinking about the future. That's stalled because of the laws against betting in America. But I would like to kind of try and work around those and make it easier to make a private bet with the person for real money about something in the future. If someone is interested in working on that, man, see me. You know, let me know, because we have a job for you, although it doesn't pay anything.
Absolutely. It's funny. I sent when I turned 25, I sent an email to a lot of people I respect, asking what they would tell their 25-year-old selves. Mm. And a lot of people had these really expansive answers. And I appreciate that you gave kind of this one specific bit of feedback, which is what you said earlier, you regret that you were so do-it-yourself. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I don't have that problem in that I'm not doing everything myself. In fact, maybe I have the other problem. I'm delegating too much. But, it's as you've learned to delegate, what are your rules when you delegate? When you evaluate the person you're about to co-found something with, what do you think about?
That's a good question. I think it, in all honesty, it depends on whether this is a perceived one-time task. So, for instance, I'm a big believer in Elance, which is kind of like eBay for freelancers. So, just specking out a job and then looking at the best candidate, and you can on Elance you can look at their reputation, how many jobs they've done, what their ranking is, what their bid is for the amount of money, what their experience, how well they communicate. And that's just, that's kind of like it's a one-time thing. You may not see them again for that. That job may only be done once. Then there's kind of what happens when you're hiring, which I had, did some at Wired and at Whole Earth and have done here. That's a very different process. And it also depends on what kind of organization you're coming into. I recall Jeff Bezos's heuristic when he was hiring Amazon, because it was growing so fast, and he was saying the number one thing that he was looking for in a person who he hired was their ability to hire other people, because that's mostly what they would be doing for a while. I think for me, I think a lot of it is communication and personal comfort, just a level of wanting to be around someone, kind of a personal chemistry, I guess, is really important. And I maybe place more emphasis on that than I did earlier. Also, when we were at Wired, we had a saying, which I still think is true, which is that we hire attitude and you train for skill, meaning that the specific knowledge is not as crucial as the general attitude about how you learn and how you adapt and all those kinds of other intangibles. And I think that's also true for me as well. I think when you're doing a project that is maybe at a higher level with lots of innovation, creativity, you definitely want to try and hire people that are better than you. And I say try, just meaning, they're often maybe not as affordable as you would like, but you try, the trying part is coming up with something that can work to entice them to join you. And I think that's that's where it becomes difficult, because we can identify people better than us, but getting them to work on our project is, and I learned a lot from Stuart Brand, who has a remarkable ability to do this. And the thing that I noticed that made him successful in hiring people who were better than him was he's very empathetic, an amazing skill of empathy. And what he did was he would tell the person he was trying to hire, he would put himself completely in their shoes and tell them the things that, that they wanted to hear, why this, why working with him was going to benefit them. So he could be very persuasive to tell people who are really good why working with him was going to be the best thing for them that ever happened. Not for him, but for them. And that requires an incredible degree of empathy to do. And so if you have that, if you can cultivate that, of being able to see it from their point of view and why this would be beneficial to them, then that's how you do it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, also related to earlier this conversation, definition of success, you talked about, you know, not only that, you know, when you want to do something that no one else is doing, but you success to you is the kind of making your own slot.
Yes.
Why is that the case? How did you come across that philosophy?
It took me a long time to get there. And I think I wrote a little piece about this for Seth Godin at one point. And it came, the realization came pretty late when I was at Wired magazine. And it goes back to this idea of trying to give ideas away. And so I think in the first phase of life, most people are, you know, their first job, they're just trying not to get fired. They're trying to make sure they do the job well. And they're happy just to do it well. And then later on, if that works out, they may graduate to a position or a job where they continue to do it well, but they also they feel that they're really good at it, that it kind of there's a mastery of it. And then, you know, ideally, they're also going to be well paid for it. And so there comes a moment when you think, oh my gosh, you know, here it is. I'm doing something that I love to do. Other people love it, and I get paid. And that seems like that's the peak. But my experience at Wired, I realized that there was something after that. And it came from, you know, being editor and having lots of good ideas and trying to get writers to you know, write these story ideas. And when you're editor, you're constantly telling people these great ideas. And I'd have a great idea and I'd try to sell it to a writer and, you know, there was no interest. They thought it was dumb or stupid or not good enough or whatever. And then I would forget about it. I'd say, well, that's probably a stupid idea. And then maybe they would come back and a year later, I'd have the idea again. Say, you know, that was a good idea. And I'd try to sell it again and it wouldn't go. I thought, well, okay. And that would happen a number of times. And then maybe by, like, you know, the third or fourth year, I'm thinking, you know, this is still a good idea. And I try to keep killing it, but it doesn't work. It keeps coming back and no one else will do it. And then it was like, oh my gosh, I need to write this one. And those often turned out to be the best ones I wrote. And I realized that it was because no one else could write it. And so I started more consciously look at the ones and the ideas that I couldn't kill. I kept, and I would really go through the process of trying to get rid of them. And no one else thought was interesting, but I just thought was really great. And then I learned to try to focus on the things that only I could do that were, you know, that other people would like. You still have to adhere to those initial conditions. And that's actually very, very difficult to do because when you're young, you don't, or at least I didn't know what I was really good at. I couldn't have done that earlier because I didn't really have a good sense of what only I could do. But as I got older, I got a better sense of that. So, and the way I would say it now is that basically this quest is what your life is about. I mean, that is it. It's to do the things that you are here to do that only you can do, but it's going to take you all your life and to figure it out because the way you figure it out is by living. I mean, that's what your life is for in a basic sense.
Why is it better to do what only you can do rather than be the best, you know, at something that a lot of people can do?
That's a good question. I think for two reasons. One is, I think that if you are really the best, you will naturally move to that, saying that, that position of only you can do. So we could think of, say, like, you know, a basketball star. And you could say, well, any professional basketball player is kind of like the best. But there is certainly a sense in which the really greatest basketball stars were, in some ways, they were doing it in a way that no one else could do. And so I guess maybe my answer, as I'm thinking through this, would be the difference between being kind of like good or great. Good is like you're the best at it. Great is that you're the only one. And so that's what I'm saying is, I think in the beginning, you're kind of like, you get to the point of being really, really, really good. But if you wanted to be great, then you have to move to the place where it's only you can do it.
And when you talk about initial conditions, you mean just to protect against someone pursuing something like super, super esoteric just because no one else is doing it?
Yeah, I mean, you still have to be valuable to others, or other. You still have to enjoy it and all those other things. So it's a cumulative, you know, you build upon these other attributes that, yeah, I mean, you can do something that only you can do, but if no one else in the entire world ever finds it valuable, it's not really great. I think that's part of the definition of being good or a master and great is that you have to have some utility to others, some connection to other people.
It's interesting. Are there ways to accelerate this process of finding out what you're really good at or what you can only do?
You know, that is such a great question. And I must confess, I had not thought about it before, but I, as soon as you said it, I realized that that's extremely important. The one thing, and I don't have a ready answer for it because I haven't thought about it, but the one thing I would say is that I am utterly convinced that the way you get there is by using others, by having others around you, that you can't do that by yourself in isolation. And that's sort of what the role of others around you in terms of either getting feedback, getting responses, telling you that it's a stupid or a good idea, or in some ways engaged with people around you. So that's sort of their role in, so to accelerate it, I would say is you really want to have people around you. And that is an art, because everybody knows the stories about, I mean, there's nothing you can do that is going to please everybody. And so that art of subtracting some amount of negative response out and listening to the stuff that does apply to you and learning from it, there's really no formula for that, but that is, you know, that is the recipe. And I think, you know, I know Derek Silvers, who talks about the trying to fail. And I think that's the second way you accelerate it, which is that it's like doing science. If you accelerate science, that means you're going to accelerate the rate of failures. And you also want to fall or fail forward, meaning you want to construct things so that you are learning even as you fail. And so those two things, I think, would be the two ways to accelerate, which is basically just do more. I'm a big believer in the quantitative path to quality, which is, you know, you do something every day, you do a lot of it, you do it again and again, you keep doing it, you do it more than anybody else, you know, the 10,000 hour plus, you just do it very deliberately, trying to fail. So I think these processes of doing a lot, taking great risks, employing others, those are three things that I would say would accelerate it.
Yeah, very consistent with philosophy I've read and believe in. Cal Newport's So Good They Can't Ignore You.
Yes, and I have to say that book changed my mind. because I believed with a lot of other people that, you know, to follow your bliss, find out what your passion and money would follow. And he rightly, I think, convinced me that the actual trajectory of most people is that in the very beginning, they become paralyzed in trying to discover your passion. You don't know what your passion is. You're, you know, you just graduated from high school, whatever it is, and you have no idea. And you have heard this, you want to follow your passion, but you follow my passion, follow my passion. I don't know what my passion is. So you don't go anywhere, you don't do anything, and you're waiting to find your passion. And once you find your passion, then you're going to really give it 110%. He suggests that you go the other way around, is that you find your passion through mastery. You master something, anything, doesn't matter what it is. The first thing that comes along, you just decide you're going to master it. And through your mastery, you begin to find out what you're really good at and what your passion is, and that you can only get to your passion through mastery of something. And I think that's probably closer to the way things really work.
You know, it's interesting. When you were talking about quantified self, in my joke, I thought about, what about, you know, the qualified self? And what I mean by that is, do you ever feel, obviously, you know, quantifying things is fantastic, but do you ever feel that sometimes the best things are very difficult to quantify, and that if we focus on quantifying too much, we focus on kind of these ineffable, you know, qualities like love and this sort of thing? And
yeah, I'm very much into kind of moderation and everything. I think that if all you're doing was quantifying, you would seriously miss most of life. But I think that's not what we mean by it. We mean that this is another tool that you can do in addition to things, and that you should, you know, you should take technical sabbaticals. You should take a Sabbath. You should turn your things off. You should take a vacation. You should have, I have a list of techno literacies, and one of them is that there's face-to-face should always trump anything else. So if you're meeting someone face-to-face, all these other means should be subsumed and deferred. If you're on the phone, then you know you shouldn't be doing your email while you're on a phone. You should you know, defer the things that are lower on the list. And I think, of course, quantification is not the only way. Meditation, all these other things are as valuable there. And in my view of technology, these are always an additive process. This is an additional option without taking the old options away, and we still have the old options. I'm surrounded by paper books. I have ebooks and paper books. You know, there's a walk in the outside, and there's, you know, going on to Second Life, whatever. So these things are options, and we have increasing options, and that's what we get from technology.
It's funny you bring up meditation. Me and a few friends have started, you know, relatively recently, meditation groups that have been picking up a bit. And one of the people involved is someone who was somewhat early in the quantified self movement, and he's trying to teach us kind of the principles that led to you guys expanding, you know, as you say, slowly over time, but you know, the simplicity of it, the community element to it, and it seems like there's a real rise in meditation, which is an old technology, in the time of new technology, you know.
Yeah, it is old, and what I would expect over the next, say, you know, 20, 30 years is that we'll use technology of, you know, brain scans and other things to actually to make technology, I mean, make meditation better. There's if it really does work, and it does, then we can improve it. And so we might actually begin to use self-tracking to actually make meditation work better than it does.
You know, what do you believe happens to humans once jobs get significantly lost to technology? What do they do? How do we react?
Our job is to make new jobs for the robots.
Do humans make new jobs for the robots? Do they get paid for that? How did the humans
live? Sure.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, that's our... Because, you know, the robots will continue to make wealth. They'll make all the things that we want. And But our job is to keep coming up with new jobs that they can do.
Do we move planets pretty soon? Or how do we handle this?
No, I don't think. In fact, I think most of the, I mean, if we're talking about like in the next 100 years,
yeah,
most of the material changes, in 100 years you come back to the city of San Francisco, it will not look that much different than it does right now. Because that's the industrial age. That already happened, the movement of matter. Most of the changes in the next 100 years would be in information and biological, changing both, you know, our relationships with each other through these technologies and, you know, our own bodies. But the material world is that'll be a much slower change.
What does legacy mean to you?
Old.
Or like, how do you think about your own legacy?
Oh, that. I think make it like a legacy system. My own legacy. Oh boy. I can tell you with great certainty that in 5,000 years, no one will have a clue that either you or I ever existed.
You're killing my dreams, Kevin.
Nope. 5,000 years, we are completely 100% forgotten.
Why that number? What makes you? Or
how, well, do you, okay. How many people do you know of 5,000 years ago?
Not very many. Zero?
Yeah, zero, right. And even if there was 10, that's still very low odds. We have 7 billion people. The odds that any one of us has remembered 5,000 years from now, where change is even happening faster, it's just statistically, I can guarantee you that we won't be remembered.
So Jesus also will be forgotten?
Probably.
Do you believe in a higher power above, you were saying, yes, equating technology to nature, but you believe in a higher power beyond both of that? Or, because some people equate nature with the higher power.
I definitely believe in God. I think there is a, I think logically that's the best solution to the question of where did the universe come from? So I would say yes. I acknowledge that there is a self-created creator. So the choices seem to be, you either have a creation that was self-created, always, and the universe always was, or it made itself somehow out of what? Or that there was a self-created creator, a being that self-created itself that made the universe. Equal though, both of those options are very unsatisfactory.
Yeah, it's interesting. And some people equate it with nature, but it seems you put nature in technology. I haven't heard that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nature is, life is, yeah, I mean, you can, technology is a subset of life. It's called the seventh kingdom of life. It's evolution accelerated. Basically, technology is a way to populate the world with, like, say, species of minds that DNA could not get to by itself. So it creates this other mechanism to make, like, thinking, not using, say, DNA stuff. It uses silicon, but it couldn't get there unless it went through light first.
You experimented with some sort of hallucinogen, like at an old age.
Yeah, I didn't take any drugs at all. Zero, nothing, no pot, no nothing. Until I was 50, and on my 50th birthday, I dropped acid. And it was good acid, I know, because I got it from a very, very canonical, reliable source. And I had a really good guide, and I recommend. I think it's there's a cool tool book called, I think, Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. I can't remember. But I recommend, if you're going to experiment, to do it that way rather than recreationally. I made it sort of slightly of a sacrament, and it was a sacrament. And I think where the country is finally starting to make a little bend in trajectory and reevaluate the worth of this technology, which has been, of course, illegal and to the point where you couldn't even do research proving that there was no harm and that it was actually good. But now that's beginning to change, so I think we're going to see more of it. I didn't do more after that or more like that because I find that I didn't have a craving for it, the insights were sufficient. Once was sufficient, and it's sort of like, I don't know, like if you go to the pyramids, the Grand Canyon, the Taj Mahal, there's something happened, but I didn't ever feel like I need to go back again.
Is there another big thing in your life that you want to experiment with that you haven't yet?
That's a good question. I've done some of those little brain machine interface helmets where you're controlling the computer with your brain. The right thing there would certainly attract me. I'm not ready to have any surgery, but a non-invasive thing I definitely would give a try and see, and maybe intensive VR experiments. I've never done sensory deprivation tank. That would be interesting. I think there's a small list of things I just have never gotten around to try.
Yeah. Okay, I want to respect your time. So last two questions I'll just ask right now. One, where do you stand on kind of nature versus nurture in terms of our actions and our abilities to improve and change our actions? And two, what do you want? You talked about this concept of legacy, you know, but being too long that we're not going to have a legacy. But what do you, in your short term, what do you want people to say at your funeral, which is hopefully not that short term?
Yeah.
But
the nature nurture, I would say on average it's 50-50. And of course that would vary tremendously depending on what we're talking about. So maybe sometimes it goes to 20-80 in some instances, and maybe 60-40. So, but on average, it's probably close to 50-50. I think that's probably the best way to think about it. That there's always going to be a component of both. As far as a eulogy, I actually like David Brooks's New York Times columnist who wrote recently about I think he called them resume virtues versus eulogy virtues. And the idea was a lot of people are working on things for the resume, and what really counts is the things that your eulogy. And boy, you know, I have been to a number of funerals, and it is amazing that nobody talks about your SATs or the projects that you completed, and they talk about other character things, what you were like while you were doing things. And so, you know, they're not going to say, oh, yeah, he helped start Wired Magazine. They're going to say, what was I like with people that I didn't know, a stranger? What would I like people to remember? Let's see. I guess I would have to say that I was off the chart optimistic about most things. I don't know if they will, but maybe I should put that in my will.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to close off of.
Yeah, I am. I'm not saying that. Actually, I am, and I think that's partly by temperament, but also has become much more deliberate as well. And I just think that people behave better when they're optimistic. And I think that you have a choice, and that if you you can choose to be more optimistic than you were, and that doing so creates longer, more long-term benefits by being optimistic about the future.
Cool. That's a fantastic note to end on. Kevin, thank you. This was a great chat.
Sure. Thanks for taking the time. Great questions.